Hello and welcome to another episode of the Menswear Style Podcast with me, your host, Pete Brooker. And on this week's episode, we're going to be talking watches. We know they have to be swish, but do they have to be Swiss? I'll be speaking to one of the co-founders of the British watch manufacturing company Bremont, Giles English, as he gives me a little insight into the history of the name. His name was Bremont, or his surname was Bremont. Forgive me, I forgot his first name. How is your relationship with him now? Is he still about? Is he still going?
No, he died a few years after.
Oh, bollocks. Yes, always do your research. I find it helps. We're also going to be talking to... Hello?
Hello, little man.
Oh, hey, Christopher Walken. How you doing? Look, I'm kind of in the middle of something right now. Any chance we can do this another...
Boy, I sure heard a bunch about you.
And yeah, that's very sweet. The podcast is doing well. Speaking of the podcast, I was actually in the middle of doing one. So, Chris, if we could do this...
See, I was a good friend of your dad's.
Oh, wow.
We were in that Hanoi pit of hell together.
Oh, God.
Over 5 years.
5 years. Wow, okay.
Hopefully...
Yes.
You'll never have to experience this yourself, but when two men are in a situation like me and your dad were for as long as we were...
Oh, God, Chris, really, I don't need to know. Please, please.
You take on certain responsibilities of the other.
Okay.
If it had been me who...
Yeah, okay. Look, please, Chris, I'm going to get back to you.
Major Coolidge, you'd be talking right now to my son.
Sure.
Jim.
Gotcha. Right, okay, we'll crack on. We'll come back to Christopher Walken, I swear. We've got a jam-packed episode this week. We're also going to be talking to Mike France, one of the co-founders of Christopher Ward. He tells me who he thinks will be a great ambassador for his company.
I just love the kind of... he's a pretty successful chap, but B, he has a sort of... he doesn't take himself that seriously, although he does a really serious job. Yeah. He just seems like a decent guy.
Yes, any ideas on who he's referring to? So from Christopher Ward to Christopher Walken, let's just check in, see where he's up to.
This watch I got here was first purchased by your great-grandfather during the First World War.
Wow, that is a thing of beauty.
It was bought in a little general store in Knoxville, Tennessee. Made by the first company to ever make wristwatches.
Okay, honestly, that is fascinating stuff, Christopher Walken. Please hold that for, and we'll come back to it, I swear. But also, we'll...
Up till then, people just carried pocket watches.
Okay, I got it.
Bought by private doughboy Orion Coolidge on the day he set sail for Paris.
Gotcha. Moving on, we're also going to be talking to John Argento, the head of Europe for Shinola Watches, a Detroit-based company. We're going to be talking all things Detroit, all things watches, and all things RoboCop.
Well, I tell you this, I've been to Detroit quite a few times, and my last trip was just a couple of months ago, and I have not yet spotted a RoboCop statue. I'm pretty sure that's something I would have seen if it was if it was up somewhere.
Fascinating stuff there. Stay tuned for that interview coming up shortly. Let me just check in on Christopher, see if he's still rambling on.
The way your dad looked at it, this watch was your birthright. You'd be damned if any slope's going to put the greasy yellow hands on his boy's birthright. So he hid it.
He hid it? Where?
In one place he knew he could hide something. His ass.
Five
long years he wore this watch.
No.
Up his ass.
Ugh.
Then...
Okay, I got it. Thanks, Christopher. Really, it's a lovely watch. I don't think I need another watch, especially the one that's been up my dad's ass. We're also going to be speaking to Elizabeth Dewar, one of the co-founders of Quill and Pad. She's going to be...
He died of dysentery. Give me the watch.
Got it, yeah.
I hid this uncomfortable hunk of metal up my ass 2 years.
It's up your ass as well.
After 7 years, I was sent home to my family.
Okay, right.
Now?
Yep.
Little man.
Yeah.
I gave the watch to you.
That's great. Thanks, Jesus. Wow, what a gift, Christopher. A watch that's been up your ass and my dad's ass. I will treasure it. Moving on, we will now crack on with the podcast. We will speak to Giles English, one half of Bremont Watches. Okay, so on the podcast now, we have Giles English, who is the co-founder of Bremont Watches. How are you doing, Giles?
I'm very well. Lovely to speak to you.
And to you too. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to speak to me today. Firstly, I chanced upon the website and looked at the video, the promotion video, and thought it was very interesting. Before we get into Bremont, do you mind just giving us a little bit of history about yourself? Brag a little bit, and then we'll get into the brand itself.
Yeah, brag a little bit. Bremont started by myself and my brother Nick, and it all really came from growing up with this amazing dad and PhD aeronautical engineer from Cambridge who loved his watches and clocks. So it really grew up around that. And he very sadly died in a plane crash in 95 with my brother, and my brother survived. And that was for us the tipping point to go and do something we loved. And we were always really aware that, you know, Britain had this amazing history of watchmaking, but there were very few British watch companies still making watches.
Yeah, so you've got an aviation background alongside your brother yourself. How did you make that switch from aviation over to watches?
Yeah, I trained as an engineer. Actually, I was always going to be a naval architect designing boats. But we grew up around aviation. My father had a business restoring old aircraft. And it's quite interesting, you know, my view is if a watch is, it's about gears and great case design and general design. And whether it's that, an engine or an aircraft, it's really about assembling of those components so they work together. And so once we obviously learned the details of watchmaking, I had a very good idea through growing up and restoring clocks. And we went over to Switzerland for 5 years and really learned the trade and brought our experience into it. So it's not an easy transition, but for an engineer, it's logical.
Mm. And did you have to convince your brother, or did he have to convince you, or was it a meeting of the minds? How did it work?
Yeah, it was a sort of, we both had this love for it, and it was a very, very high risk strategy for us to take on at the time. And you tell your wife it's going to be I'm going to be 2 or 3 years and we'll start selling watches. We didn't sell a single watch for 5 years, so it's quite a hard one to tell your wife. But so it wasn't a natural business idea, but I think post what we'd been through with our dad and Nick getting out of hospital, it was, well, sod that. We could be dead tomorrow. Let's go and live life.
Absolutely. And what better part than in Switzerland? So whereabouts in Switzerland were you based?
So Bienne was where we were sort of based, and we started building our original watches around there. But the whole idea was to bring them back to the UK, and a various stage process to be able to do that. And that on stage one was training out watchmakers and watch assemblers. Post that, it was all the stock systems and everything else you need around that. And then three was actually machining bits of metal in the UK as well. And it's been a long and high investment process, but it's really exciting. It seems to be working.
Excellent. Well, Giles, do you mind just holding my hand through this process? So you've got the parts coming from Switzerland, all the design and all of the, I'd say the inspiration was more for the English side, and the manufacturing and the casing and the glass is English manufactured, unless I'm wrong on that. So where do the two meet? Where do you actually say, look, this is a British watch as opposed to imported Swiss parts?
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, well, I look at our cost base. We have 90 odd people, and they're all based in the UK, manufacturing part of that process. Now, obviously, we're making cases and that sort of stuff in our own workshops, and some key movement components. We're doing all the design over here, both CAD and visual. So our cost base is here, but we're still reliant on Swiss components. We'll be for many years, and until that skill set is in the UK, and then you can't do it. And historically, watch companies have not built every component of a watch. I mean, it's very similar to the car industry. You do, specialisms like dial printing and that sort of stuff. you very rarely do you try and do in-house because it's such a specialist area. Mm. Even place things like plating, certain bits of engraving, watch companies historically not done themselves. So it's really where that line starts and finishes. But yeah, all of our cost base is in the UK, and you know, that's a large part proportion of anything goes into a watch.
Excellent. I just loved it. I mentioned the video earlier. One of the loveliest parts of that video that I learned from it was how you and your brother were flying over a part of France and landed in a field, had to crash land, ditch the airplane. And one of the local farmers came out and helped you out. And his name was Bremont, or his surname was Bremont. Forgive me, I forgot his first name. How is your relationship with him now? Is he still about? Is he still going?
No, he died a few years after.
Oh, bollocks.
So sadly, but we told him what we're doing, and he thought, you crazy Englishman. And, you know, he was never a great friend. I mean, we never knew him that well. But when we met him and he helped us out, I mean, when you force land in France, it's very different to England. England, you just give the farmer a bottle of whiskey and say sorry. In France, it's illegal. They impound your aircraft. They make you ship it to an airfield. So we were rightly shitting ourselves. And and this old boy helped us out. And he just reminded us of our father, had he have lived till his 80s. And he, lovely old boy, restoring these old tractors. And we just had a real bond with him. And at that time, all our early watches, we were making without a name on. So you know, my surname's English. We could never put English on a dial of a watch. And what Nick and I were very conscious we didn't want to do, and we could have easily have done it, was go and buy an old brand. So whether it was a Harrison or a Mudge or a Tompion, or, you know, one of the great British watchmakers. But we felt by doing that, we were constantly been living a bit of a lie, really, and pretending we were some great marine chronometer producer. And we wanted to make our own way, and hence why we wanted our own name. And we just liked the sound of Bremont as a surname. We thought, yeah, Bremont, why not? And that's really where it came from.
Excellent. It's a lovely romance to that. So I'm glad that was included in the video, because that was something nice to take away from it. Just a little bit about your collaborations, please, Giles. So how exciting was it when Jaguar approached you to get one of the watches instilled in the dashboard? And the CX-75, unless I'm mistaken, was the one that was in the Bond film, yeah?
Yeah, there was. And it was a great project. And they approached us and said, look, we love what you're doing. And we're making you know, various custom cars, and we want to do something interesting with our clocks. Would you make them for us? And it started with the CX-75, and then we did an XJ Jaguar, and then it led to all the Queen's cars, all her stretched Jaguars we built Bremont clocks for on the back. So it's a really lovely ongoing relationship, and Ian Callum is he's a, you know, such a nice guy, the chief designer of Jaguar. I've gone very well with him.
I've met him a few times. He's
he's such a nice chap. And then when they were doing these six lightweight E-types, they were recommissioning, they said, look, we'd love to do a watch for each of the owners. And I'd always loved those classic car dials, all made by Smiths, obviously the last British watch company. And it was just such a clear inspiration, something for us to effectively inspire ourselves against, and we made the watches, and we decided to go into production with them. So it's been a lovely ongoing relationship.
And at the time when they made the CX-75, though, they had no designs to put that in the Bond film, is that right? This was something that the Bond franchise came to them later in the day and said, we've seen this car, we like it, can we have it?
Yeah, they were doing it, and they were seriously interested about going to full production with it. And I think for various reasons they didn't. And then it'd been sitting around, and the Bond guy said, look, we've got to do something with that car. And it is such a lovely car. Mm. And it's, you know, a shame they haven't gone to full production with it. But yeah, no, it's a lovely thing to be part of.
Excellent. Also, just another collaboration I saw in the video was your one with Johnny Wood. So you got him involved to design one of your clocks. What's he like to work with?
Ronnie Wood is...
Oh, sorry, Ronnie Wood, bollocks.
Yeah. don't
Do you know what? I've got one of my IT guys whose name is Johnny Wood.
Jesus Johnny Wood, Rolling Stones guitarist. Ronnie, he approached us and said, look, we'd just done a clock, and would be interested in doing something with his art on it. And we did, and he painted it. And we had a lovely relationship with him and travelled around with him a bit. And just very articulate, bright, talented man, and you know, massive respect. And I think, you know, our remit in life, full stop, is life is short. If you're going to work with anyone, you've got to make sure you like them and you enjoy their company. And someone like Ronnie is just he's such a class individual, and it created this sort of quite unique clock. So it's a lovely thing to work with.
How many of the clocks were made?
We've only ever done one Ronnie clock. The clocks, though, we've done variations of it, and we've made probably about a dozen of them.
Wow. Okay. Great. Just lastly, Giles, before I let you go, you said you didn't sell a watch for 5 years. At what point did you think, crikey, we might be in trouble here? We might have to chuck the towel in and call it a day on this one.
You know, you're very close a number of times, and I think there's lots of areas when you've sunk so much into it, you pulling out is just more scary than sort of staying in there. So realistically, it was never going to be an option. We had to deliver it, and I, you know, I keep telling this rule that we've learned in life is just everything we do costs three times more, takes three times longer, and is three times the amount of effort. So it's the three times rule. And I think if you sort of work with that, you just know it's going to be hard, and you know, nothing comes easy, and you can. You think, oh, it's luck and they've got there, or whatever. But it's just hard work, and you don't give up.
And what was the turning point? I mean, imagine I watched Dragon's Den last night. I watched it quite a bit, and imagine if you brought that watch in after 5 years of not selling one, and you tell the dragons, "Look, hey, we've got so much debt, we've got so much arrears, all we have is stock." They would have just shooed you out of there pretty damn quick. So. Was there a huge turning point, like a big sale or a big brand ambassador that came on board?
I think for us, it was when we got our sort of final prototypes made, and they're really, really nice. And we loved the three-piece case, and we had this hardened steel and chronometer rated, and the, you know, quality of the hands, all of those elements. We showed it to a few journalists, and we knew they were going to be sort of slightly sniffy. They'd never heard of us before. And putting that all aside, they sort of, you know, basically said, look, we've never heard of you before, but actually, for the price point, this is a bloody good watch. And suddenly it dawned on us, we'd created a lovely product. And we knew if we could get out there and tell the story, and you know, the market, it's a big market, the watch market, but it's dominated by the big boys. But I think, you know, as we saw the whole market maturing, and it's very different in, you know, 95 and beyond that, you know, 2000 to what it is now. And we saw that these niche players like us offered something different and unique and special. And we felt there was that market. And you know, we live in a society today where you buy something and it's rubbish, it's for the bin in 12 months time, and very few things you can buy that last forever, and watches are one of those few things that you can do, and I think it always has its place.
Yeah, well, just interestingly, Giles, where is your demographic? I mean, obviously it's stuff that's going on in Switzerland, but it's also a very British brand. Is it bigger in England per se than it is across Europe?
Yeah, no, England's our biggest market, and then it's probably the US, and then sort of Asia, Middle East. And about 20% of our business is just making for the military around the world. So that's always been a big part of our business. So it's quite nice and diverse as a company. But your challenge as a watch company is you're an engineering business that is having to make things you know, very complicated things in an industry, in a country where they haven't made them forever. And then you'll also have to be a very good marketeer and retailer and all those things. So it's inherently a very complex business to be part of.
Fantastic. Well, Giles, I'm going to let you go, but thanks for jumping on the podcast. Really appreciate it. And I'll look out for some more Bremont watches in the magazines. Oh, interestingly, do you wear anything else apart from Bremont, or do you like anything else, your contemporaries?
I've always loved vintage watches, and but no, I can't be seen out with anyone else's watches. It's generally not good for PR, so yeah. I'll stick to my own.
Giles English from Bremont. Okay, so, well, just out of curiosity, Christopher, where do you get your watches from?
You scumbag. and you learn nothing from me.
Well, I learned that you hid my dad's watch up your ass, but boy, has your mood changed over the last 10 minutes. Christ.
Go to Switzerland.
Okay, now you're just stating the obvious. We'll leave it there.
Take out my dick.
Oh, God. Jesus H. Christopher, this is a family show. Look, I can't be doing this.
Take it out.
No, I'm not taking that out.
Take it out!
No! I'm just... Look, we'll move on. We're going to speak to Mike France, co-founder of Christopher Ward.
Okay, so on the podcast now, we have Mike France. Mike France is one of the co-founders of Christopher Ward. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm good, thank you, Peter.
Excellent, thanks for taking the time out. So, Mike, first question for you is, the question you probably get asked 10 times in a day, is why isn't the brand called Mike France?
Well, I am one of three co-founders, and the other two, one is Peter Ellis, and the other is Christopher Ward. And when we were looking into which name we would have on our watches, we were particularly interested in English aesthetics and wanted an English sounding name. We didn't want a made up name. We wanted it to be authentic and real. Frankly, for an English brand to have Mike France on the label, on the dial, isn't ideal. Peter Ellis, and he'll not thank me for saying this, we thought was a bit mundane, but there's a lovely lilting Englishness about Christopher Ward. It scans beautifully and is a very English sounding name. So nothing more than that, really. It sounded the best of them. We looked at different combinations. It was going to be called MPC, our Christian names, but that looked a little bit too familiar. Uh-huh. So that's what happened. It's authentic, it's real, and it's the most English-sounding name. And we're very, at one level, we're a very English brand.
Excellent. Well, it sounded like it was a unanimous decision, so... No quarrelling within the ring.
It was for Chris.
I bet he was well up for that.
He was well up for that. I didn't see him resisting too strongly.
So, Mike, just tell us a little bit about yourself, please, and how you three guys got together, and then we'll go into the brand itself. Brag a little bit, please.
Well, my background is retail, really. Ended up owning a reasonably well-known English brand called Early Learning Centre, which makes and retails educational toys for children. And we bought that brand back in the 90s. Peter Ellis and I did. Turned it round, sold it in 2004, having turned it round, the reason that we started a watch brand really is out of boredom. At one level, you think when you've sold a company, wouldn't it be nice to put your feet up for a while? But actually, after about 3 to 4 weeks, already beginning to get itchy feet, wanted to do something else. Had known Chris for many years. He'd been my assistant merchandiser back in the 80s when I was a buyer, and we'd lost touch a little but got back in touch with each other. He was at the same time we were selling Early Learning Centre, he was selling his import and export business. He was supplying Disney apparel into Europe. And we were literally on a boat on the Thames whiling a very pleasant summer's afternoon away, and we decided, why don't we do something together? Well, what will it be? And we built a pretty successful internet business at Early Learning Centre. We'd been one of the very early adopters back in sort of 97, mm-hmm. When people didn't think you could sell things like climbing frames off the internet, and we sort of disproved that theory, and the growth of that particular channel was significant at Early Learning Centre and helped to turn the business around for us. And having spent many more years than I care to mention in bricks and mortar retail, at that stage decided to have a pure online play. We wanted it to be something that we were interested in, products that we really related to, but also that had global possibilities and potential, and that were kind of relatively easy to ship around the world. Well, that ruled out sofas. Mm-hmm. So we ended up
what is it that all three of us were really into? And although we knew nothing about watches at the time from a technical aspect, I have to admit, we all love watches for different reasons, and decided, well, that's what we're going to do. And then a lot of good fortune came our way. We knew people in the industry. We were given access to information that, honestly, it would normally take people decades to find. We were being shown into top-end watch manufacturers within weeks of deciding to set the business up. And we learned some really interesting stuff in that process, because we were still in the mode of, what kind of watches are we going to do here? Where are we going to pitch this in the marketplace? And what we discovered was quite astonishing, really, for people certainly from outside the industry at that time. The two things that really were the most astonishing was, one, by large measure, the large majority of luxury watch brands were using the same components. We couldn't actually believe that the Swatch Group was through its movement manufacturer ETA was supplying huge swathes of the watch industry with the self same movements. So that was kind of curious to us. But the second thing we discovered is that we could access that as well, and therefore we thought, well, that's interesting. And then we discovered in our search through these manufacturers that some of the multiples that some of these brands were applying were quite remarkable.
You mean the markup of the watch after production?
Yeah. So if a watch, let's take any number for simplicity, if a watch was costing £100 to manufacture, the record that we found was that would be on sale under one brand name that I won't mention, but you would know very well, at £3,400.
Right. Okay.
A 34 times markup. Now, that was the most outrageous example of a markup we discovered. But most of them were around these sort of 10 to 15. And we just thought, well, that's interesting in its own right. They're genuinely largely producing the same quality of watches. And the thing that was separating them was the amount of marketing spend and branding spend that they were applying. We felt that was therefore there was an opportunity here to, with a new model, because frankly nobody had gone pure online, only on internet watches, on luxury watches at the time, a low cost distribution model that we were controlling, i.e. through the internet, combined with a different philosophy around markup. And we decided that we would apply a markup, very simply, of around three times to every cost price, which meant immediately for equivalent watches, we were going to be less than half the price of anybody who was producing something similar, and in many cases up to a fifth of the price. And that's the position we decided to adopt.
So, Mike, it says that you disrupted the industry basically by coming in and doing more realistic and honest and being very transparent with your markups. So the rest of the watch industry, have they kind of taken notice of this and reduced their markups, or how have they reacted?
Well, I mean, the phrase industry disruptor is gets used by people about us. We didn't really when we started, I don't think that phrase even existed. We saw an opportunity to do something. We applied ourselves to it, and it evolved. It seems that it caused a bit of disruption, not so much, I think, that anybody has really aped it as yet. And indeed, what we've seen in the subsequent sort of 12 years since we started, I think there is a trend towards brands beginning to try and take control of their own supply chain and distribution chain. So you've seen a huge growth of boutique shops that are owned by the brands over that period. But still, the vast majority of their distribution is through third parties. And I think it's a long haul for any of the traditional brands to change away from a wholesale model to our sort of model. And so there has been, although I think it's been acknowledged by people that we are doing something different. And I think with the passage of time, I think a grudging respect for what we are doing, because I think originally people were deeply suspicious that we couldn't be actually selling the quality of watch that we purported to be selling at the prices we were selling at. I think over time, of course, that's been proven not to be the case. That of course we're selling the quality of watches that we purport to sell, and I think therefore there's a grudging respect. But actually, no, there's been very little crowding of our position by anybody. Most have taken the route to wholesale distribute, which means that we're relatively protected from them.
Okay, Mike, I kind of want to just get a couple more questions in. The line's crackling a little bit, but I think we can maintain it. And you've got a guy reversing somewhere outside in the forecourt, by the sounds of it. he sounds busy.
You could be right, actually, as long as he doesn't come through the window.
Yeah. Yeah, look out through the blinds there. There might be a huge crash about to happen. Could you just tell me a little bit? So you actually have Swiss movement in all of your watches, but what part of the watch makes it British? How British, basically, is Christopher Ward?
Yeah, good question. The all of the design elements of the watch are completed here. We have our own design studio in Maidenhead. Of course, we get input from our colleagues in Beale as well, but they're largely focused on the movement side of things, and particularly our own calibre SH21, which we launched in 2014. Is the work of our master watchmaker Johannes Janker. We're about to later this autumn launch our new automatic complication of the 5-day power reserve, which will go into a new case which Adrian Bushman, our senior designer here in Maidenhead, has developed. And the case itself is an example of Englishness for us, because we when we were talking about the briefing for the design of this case, all of the influences that we wanted to bring to bear were in fact English influences, including, and I've actually got it in front of me now, Peter, because we've been talking about this watch only this morning. One of the things that my prized possession is probably my Aston Martin DB9.
Oh, yeah. Go on,
which I still think is the most beautiful car that's ever been designed. And it's beautiful from every angle, and has that sort of flowing, very English sort of sense of flowing lines. And along with... influences like taking influences from Thomas Heatherwick, the famous English designer, who's famous for things like the Rolling Bridge et al. These are the sort of inputs that we try and bring to bear in our own inimitable way. And so all of the influences of design on this particular watch are largely from English roots. It's understated. There's a kind of an understatedness about Englishness and English design in our, we believe, and we don't shout loud. We don't want our designs to shout too loudly. There's enough of that going on, and we're trying really hard to develop a more understated but very distinctive signature. And I think we're still working on that. And The C1 is probably the example that I'm most proud of this sort of English signature that we're trying to bring to bear. So the design is really and the kind of, I think also the if you like the sort of attitude of ourselves makes the brand English. In some regards, I think we're as a brand, we're a little diffident. We could shout more loudly, but one of the things that we absolutely, are in awe of the watch industry and the much of it at least. But one of the things that I don't particularly like about the industry is its tendency to the hyperbolic. There is a tendency in the luxury watch industry, particularly, I think, to exaggerate.
Like the half truths, where you would say some parts aren't necessarily coming from Switzerland, but maybe sourced from Thailand.
Well, I mean, I think there's slightly different things. I think what one is whatever it is, there is a tendency to extol its virtues, in ridiculous ways. The issue that you're talking about, I think, is more to do with transparency or lack of it in the watch industry. There's no question that many brands out there whom, if people knew where, who claim to be making everything in, in Switzerland. Actually, the law in Switzerland doesn't require everything to be made in Switzerland, but nevertheless, people will claim components are produced and manufactured in Switzerland, or don't say anything, which by implication leads people to believe that they are. We try and be transparent and honest, and it's just the way we are. And I think that's, over time, I think people have begun to appreciate there is a sort of a willingness on our part to, be open about everything. And I think that's helped the brand, and it's part of the brand, in fact. I think it's quite an important characteristic of the Christopher Ward brand as to, and how it's perceived by people.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for filling us in. That was pretty educational. So just lastly, before I go,
sure.
I know you kind of cut the overheads down by not really fussing with a lot of marketing and a lot of brand ambassadors, for example. But if you could choose one brand ambassador to wear the Christopher Ward watch, especially the release of the C1 that's coming out in November, which person would you like to choose?
Oh God, that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. The one guy that I've always thought really would work well with our brand is Bradley Wiggins.
Oh.
I just love the kind of he's a pretty successful chap, but B, he has a sort of he doesn't take himself that seriously, although he does a really serious job.
Yeah.
He just seems like a decent guy. So Bradley Wiggins, there you go.
All right, good shout. All right, cheers, Mike. I've just been in the meantime trying to look up what Bond film the DB9 was in, but I don't think they even had the DB9 in a Bond film today. They went.
Oh yes, they did.
Oh, they did. Wikipedia's lying to me. God damn.
Well, they. I think it was the first of whatever was it. The first of the films that the current Bond is in. They blew up six of them, I think.
For the somersault in car when it crashed.
Absolutely, yeah. You sound like you're a DB9 fan yourself.
Well, I am. I've completely dropped the ball on that one. There's no way I could leave that in the podcast. I'll have to do some very clever editing to maneuver that one.
Very good.
I've
very
actually
good.
Seen that smashed car because they have that in the film museum down in Covent Garden. So they have what's Bond in Motion. I don't know if you've seen it, but they have.
No, I haven't actually. No.
Next time you're in London and you're near Covent Garden, down in the film museum, they have Bond in Motion. So they have pretty much all of the Bond cars apart from the AMC Hornet, I believe. That was the
pen. Oh, is that right?
That was in Fantastic. The Man with the Golden Gun. But the one that did do all the somersaults. That one is there in a smashed heap in the corner. So that's quite a
surprise. Oh, cool.
But very nice bit of kit. Well done. Thanks, Mike. I'll finally let you go.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah, have a good rest of your day, mate.
All right, you too. Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye now. Bye.
Mike France from Christopher Ward. So, Christopher, are you going to behave if I let you back on the podcast?
Whatever you say. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay, but, just kind of mind your P's and Q's. This is a family show. Even my nephew listens to this. I mean, come on.
I'm not crazy, Don't let the boy think I am.
Look, no one thinks you're crazy. We're all huge fans. But tell us, what is your favourite brand of watch?
Take out my dick.
Oh, God, there you go again. Right, that is it.
Take it out.
No, that is it.
Take it out!
You're incorrigible. Right, we're going to move on. We're going to move on to John Argento from Shinola Watches. On the podcast now, we have John Argento, the head of Shinola in Europe. How are you doing, John?
Very well, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time out to speak to us. John, please, just tell us a little bit about the brand Shinola, how it started, and especially how it got into making watches as well, please.
Sure. Well, our founder, Tom Kartsotis, I mean, he's a veteran of the watch industry. And, you know, he had quite an impressive track record. And he had been in the watch industry for, you know, over 20, 25 years. And following the, you know, economic crisis of 2008, he was inspired to create a new project. You know, watches was in his blood. It's what he knew best. And he also had this idea, again, you know, inspired by all the bad news that was coming out of the, you know, economic downturn. He cited a few key objectives in what he wanted his new project to achieve. And, you know, primarily it was to create jobs and, you know, to do that by creating as much manufacturing in the U.S. and ultimately, you know, producing products that were of super high quality, so very high values in terms of production standards. So he decided to call on his friends from the watch industry. And, you know, some of those friends are from a company called Ronda. It's a Swiss company that's essentially a world leader in the production of quartz watch movements. And it's a family business. And, you know, they had a history that went, you know, far back. And so he invited Ronda over to Detroit and introduced the idea of this project to them. And essentially what he wanted to do was to create, you know, he wanted to build a watch factory in Detroit. And the idea at first came across as crazy because Detroit, you know, didn't have any kind of watchmaking history. There was no real, you know, workforce there that had experience with watchmaking. And, you know, just the investment, and at the time when the economy was already kind of not in the healthiest of shapes, just the whole thing didn't seem to immediately click as a good idea. But ultimately, they were convinced. And, you know, that's where we are today. So we have a watch factory that was built in Detroit within an academic institution. Actually, it's called the College for Creative Studies. And Rhonda basically helped us to set up this factory there. And I mean, it was a mammoth undertaking and risk. And, you know, at that point, we didn't know whether we'd even be able to produce the watches. You know, we had, like I said, we had to build the factory. We had to find people who were qualified and then, you know, train them. And so we did that. And what happened was when we got to a point, you know, after about a year or so of essentially, you know, setting everything up and then taking a lot more time to recruit people and train them, we started to put them through, you know, production practices. And the idea initially was not to create a brand. It was actually, you know, possibly we were going to have a kind of supply chain, you know, company where we would be producing watch movements for other companies, for other brands. But in order to do this, you know, Tom had the idea that we had to show the credibility of what we were doing and the quality of what we were doing, and so like produce some of our own products so that we could show them around to these companies we would eventually want to kind of work with us. Mm-hmm. And so with that, we created a small collection of our own watches. And I think that was the true genesis of the Shinola brand. And so at that point, the idea was just to create a small assortment of about 8 watches. And, you know, I'll fast forward, but eventually what we did is we presented these watches online, and we estimated that, you know, it would take a few months probably to sell our first production run, but we were essentially asking people to buy a watch which they had never seen or held in their hands before, and they were going to pay $500 and have to wait about 4 months to receive it. So we thought, you know, this will take some time, and it'll give us a chance to kind of build up some awareness. And we had started communicating online. You know, people could follow our development process. So it was quite engaging. There was a lot of storytelling to it. Well, the interesting thing is that when we put those watches up for sale, they sold out within a week. Wow. And so that's when we knew we were really onto something. And yeah, here we are today.
Where were people buying them through? How did you market them?
They were only available online. So those initial watches were only available online. And like I said, they had to basically wait 4 months for them to be produced. Mm-hmm. And then that was the kind of spark of turning this into a bigger project. I mean, by that point, we were already quite committed, and we had already started to apply those principles that I listed earlier, you know, the job creation, the U.S. manufacturing angle, and producing quality products to other categories. And so our key pillar, so while we're known primarily for our watches, we're also making leather goods, we make bicycles, we make, you know, journals and notebooks, and we're extending that into a whole range of other product categories. You know, later this year, we'll be introducing jewelry. We will also be introducing an audio program, which will include turntables and speakers and headphones. And, you know, we've talked about hopefully within the next year or so opening up an eyewear factory. We're looking into the area around Chicago to do that. So, you know, Shinola's just getting started, but it's on a mission to basically carry out these principles in a much bigger way than what we're doing today.
Excellent. I mean, it's still a relatively young company, isn't it? I think originally it was a shoe polish company, if that's correct. And then Tom came in around about 2001 and took it on and developed it into a watchmaking business. So it's a manufacturing workforce in Detroit, but yet it's Swiss, uses Swiss movement. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I should clarify that, yeah, Shinola, the name brand, is in fact an old company. I mean, it's over 100 years, and it was indeed a shoe polish brand. In 2011 is when Shinola was founded, and Shinola was the name we acquired to kind of name this project, this brand. And the idea is that, you know, Shinola was meant to represent what, you know, at the time that Shinola shoe polish was at its peak, it really represented the best in American, you know, reputation for quality innovation, design, and good stuff coming out of the U.S. Today, it's true that we're based out of Detroit. We are a very proud American company. We chose to call Detroit our home. But what we've done is actually we're not creating Swiss movements, or we're not using Swiss movements. We have our own factory, and within that factory, we have components. Some of those components are from Switzerland. Some are from other countries. And basically, with those components, we build watches in our Detroit factory. You can actually even go online on our website, you know, on Shinola.com or Shinola.co.uk. And, you know, we have videos. You can see, my colleagues basically, you know, making watches in the factory. So the movements that we make, and like I said, Ronda was the company, it's a Swiss watch company that helped us set up our factory, are of equal, standing, I guess, to the Swiss movements that are coming out of a Ronda factory in Switzerland.
Okay, so you have Swiss parts then, effectively.
We do.
But they're assembled in Detroit, in the factories there. Is it an assembly line? How many people do you have on the line, and how many people are actually watchmakers, trained horologists, putting the parts together?
Yeah, I mean, assembly line, you could say yes in some ways, but it's much more than that. I mean, it's a group of people who essentially rotate positions. So, of course, they are quite specialized in the production of certain areas, but they all kind of, or most of them, can rotate. So while they might be on one shift executing a particular thing, you know, producing something particular, they may not be doing that the whole day, and then might move to a different aspect of the watch that they'll be working on. Your question about how many of them are actual watchmakers, I mean, all of them are now watchmakers, but interestingly, when we first started to recruit, we only had two people who had previous watch experience, who we would have called watch trainers when they walked in through the door. Most of the people that we recruited had no previous watchmaking history. We did have a lot of people who had manufacturing experience. You know, Detroit, at the end of the day, was kind of the, you know, capital of U.S. manufacturing, and especially with the auto industry, we found a lot of people who had very strong manufacturing skills. I mean, in terms of the leather straps that we make, we actually have our own leather strap factory as well within the Detroit facility. You have a lot of people who used to work in the upholstery departments of car assembly. So they were working on, you know, making the seats and things like that. So we have a very strong, dedicated team. In terms of numbers of employees in Detroit, well, I would say globally now, Shinola has in excess of 500 employees. About half of those people are working in some aspect of manufacturing. And the mission is to, you know, continue to grow that. We want to create more jobs. We want to open up more factories, and we want to, become bigger.
Okay, great. John, I was wondering if you could settle a little debate that I was having with some friends the other day. I've got a friend that, excuse me, is a keen watch buyer. And his one stipulation when he goes out and buys a watch, he's got numerous different brands in his collection. He always says it has to be Swiss made. It's kind of his thing. And I think a lot of other people share that philosophy. Would you say yourself that it has to be Swiss made? A decent watch has to come from Switzerland, or is that myth ready to be debunked?
Well, I wouldn't entirely agree. I mean, certainly, you know, Swiss made is a mark of distinction that is, you know, renowned and respected. So there's nothing to take away from that. But there are a lot of other, you know, reputable watch companies outside of the U.S. who are not using Swiss movements, who I would argue are equally valuable and of great quality, of equal quality even. I think, you know, the kind of movement the watch has, in all honesty, is probably dependent on the category of watch you're looking for. I mean, I would say up to a certain price level, you know, somewhere around $400 maybe, it's less important. I mean, there are massive watch businesses that have been built on, you know, production that has nothing to do with Switzerland. But I think it becomes more important, you know, just like anything else, of quality when you start to enter into a different level. You know, the watches that we produce have basically, we've adopted Swiss expertise. I mean, the Swiss ultimately are experts at watchmaking. And so we have learned from them. We've adopted a lot of their practices. And yeah, I would say that within the industry, it's certainly a lot of learnings that have been adopted by other countries. And we have successfully applied that to what we do.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Great. So, I mean, it's still... it's an ambiguous argument, really. It's one that will probably rage on, but nothing will be absolutely resolute because it's all opinion and conjecture. Lastly, John, where does Shinola sell best then? If it's made in Detroit, but you're the head of marketing over there in Europe, where's your key demographic and where is Shinola getting shipped to the most?
Well, you know, we're an American company that was initially founded, like I said, in Detroit. And so we started in our domestic market. So the U.S. continues to be the strongest market for us. We have extended into, you know, initially into Canada and then eventually came over to Europe just under 2 years ago. And so while we're performing well outside of the U.S., the U.S. still remains the number one market. You know, interestingly, we do have, especially out of our own retail stores, we do have a lot of international traffic. And we're seeing that the appeal of the Shinola brand extends just really across the globe. I mean, we have a lot of requests from Asia, from the Middle East, and also from other European countries where we haven't quite penetrated as deeply yet. So we're very optimistic that that the brand will continue to grow and that, you know, people essentially love what we do. I mean, there is great, you know, pride in what we're doing, but it really ultimately the customer decides on whether they like what we're doing. And they love our story. They love our product. Our quality is, you know, unparalleled. We're very optimistic and happy with what we've achieved.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for joining us, John. Thanks for taking time out of your day. Like I said, if you want to check out the Shinola range, I guess Shinola.com is the place to go.
That's right. And we also have Shinola.co.uk.
Excellent.
And we have a store in the Soho neighborhood of London at 28 Fubert's Place.
Excellent. So go check that out if you're local. And lastly, John, I know I keep saying lastly, but this is, you must get asked this all the time, but do you know if they've actually got a RoboCop statue built in Detroit yet?
a RoboCop statue.
I mean, they petitioned for it. So they were going to make a statue, and the mayor said, he put it out to the people, who would you like to be canonized? Who would you like to be celebrated? One guy said RoboCop. They dismissed it. And then everyone in Detroit went, actually, that's a brilliant idea. And they put a petition together, and I heard, last I heard, they were building it. So it was going to get built, but I haven't actually seen anything else anywhere else. But I was wondering if you had your eyes on the ground over there in Detroit, whether you'd know anything about that.
Well, I tell you this, I've been to Detroit quite a few times, and my last trip was just a couple of months ago, and I have not yet spotted a RoboCop statue. I'm pretty sure that's something I would have seen if it was if it was up somewhere. But no, are you hoping that it comes to light anytime soon?
Oh, God, yeah.
That'd be immense. Be another reason to get to Detroit, right?
Exactly.
Come and see us, and then to also see RoboCop.
Well, it'll be part of the tour, yeah. I'd have an open-top bus to see that. That'd be great.
Well worth it.
Okay, thanks, John. I'd better let you go, but take care, and everyone check out the Shinola Watch Range. It looks very good on the line, so
Thank you, Peter. Speak to you soon.
Okay.
Thanks.
Take care, mate. Bye-bye. John Argento there from Shinola. Thanks for that, John. Christopher, I don't suppose you've got anything to add?
No.
Really? I mean, earlier on you couldn't stop talking about watches and now you have nothing to say?
I said no.
Okay, you don't think you're being a little bit churlish?
I don't want to.
Okay, well that kind of sums it up. I mean, I got you on the podcast. I thought you might have some kind of insight, but this was a bad choice.
I don't care.
Yeah, I guess that. You know what? You're a grown man, Christopher. I expected better from you.
Too bad.
It is too bad, because I wanted to talk about watches with you, but if you don't want to talk about watches, I'm going to speak to someone that does. I'm going to speak to Elizabeth Duer, the editor-in-chief at Quill and Pad. Take it away.
Okay, so on the podcast now, we have the editor-in-chief and co-founder of Quill and Pad, Elizabeth Duer. Elizabeth, am I saying your name right?
That's absolutely correct. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us today. So Elizabeth, just tell us a little bit about the site, please, Quill and Pad, a little bit about yourself. Brag a little, if you will, please.
Well, I've been a journalist in the watch industry for over 20 years. I've written a few books. I've written for many, many, many magazines. And the time came to develop something of my own because I felt like the times were right to do that. And so I co-founded Quill and Pad with a good friend of mine, Ian Skellern, who's been a watch journalist in Switzerland for many years as well. And we focus basically on the high end of watchmaking, the luxury timepieces, the complicated mechanics, and also the independent scene, which is something most people are not familiar with.
Okay, cool. The first question that I really have in the pressing of my mind is, how much attention do women actually pay to a man's watch? Is it? And obviously you do, but in terms of like your friends, is it something that they notice? Is it something more than the shoes, more than the eyes? How much does a man's watch come into play?
Well, for me personally, I look at the watch before the eyes or the shoes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I can't say that's typical. I would, in fact, say that's not typical.
Sure. I mean, is there something that can give it away, whether it's a cheap watch? I mean, I see so many watches now at a glance, I think, wow, that's quite a nice fancy watch. And then you kind of investigate it a little more and then perhaps it's not all it seems.
That's very true. The astounding thing is that a lot of the parts that someone will notice from the outside, the case, the bracelet, the strap, in many cases come from the same place as maybe a more expensive watch might have. The cheap watches, the expensive watches tend to kind of source their parts in a lot of the same places, but what will set them apart is design and the quality of the finish. So after the parts come out of the machine, what they do with it then will set it apart from each other. And that's in general when you're talking about lower cost watches, mid-range watches. On the expensive watches, everything is customized, obviously, so every part of a watch will be for that watch and not off the rack. I think most people can't tell the difference unless they look closer. At a glance, it is hard to see. I agree.
And do you think that annoys the real top-end brands of watches? Is it something that's just come along in the last 5 years or so that, you know, cheaper watches are now upping their game in terms of aesthetics?
I think possibly, and it might have a lot to do with, and I don't have any evidence to back this up. I haven't ever been asked this question, to be honest, but I think the fake industry has a lot to do with it. There's a lot of things coming out of China, for example, these days, where the quality is really quite good. It's surprisingly good, comparatively speaking, and it is hard to tell what's what and where things come from these days. And I think because the fakes are now becoming so good that even the lower end manufacturers have had to up their games.
Right, okay. I guess that's where a brand would actually just lean back on its own name slightly, though. If you are the likes of an Amiga or a Seiko or something like that, you just go, well, it's okay. We know that people will recognize the watch through the name. So yeah. You know, that's why we have brand loyalty as such.
And that's exactly true. That's many brands actually use their name as their branding, or their quote unquote Swiss made, if you will. Even if they are Swiss made, if you're a Cartier or whoever, you don't actually need that Swiss made on the dial.
Yeah.
There are several brands who choose not to put it on the dial anymore, relying on their brand name, which is actually quite smart because the brand is actually more of a quality seal than the Swiss made seal, in my opinion.
No, it's okay. I thought you were going to expand. But moving on to the Swiss, I mean, I was talking to a couple of friends. I mean, when they go watch shopping, you know, I have one friend who's got the prerequisite that it has to be a Swiss watch. So speaking to the guys at Bremont and speaking to the chap over in Shinola, so they have their parts imported from Swiss, and they put it all together there. How important is it, do you think, to have everything manufactured in Switzerland for it to be a really good finished product?
Well, it is a great signpost for somebody who's looking for a good watch and maybe doesn't know the industry that well. That Swiss made is a great first flag. To say, okay, I don't know the difference. I'm not loyal to a specific brand. And how do I know what's a good watch? And using that Swiss made label is a great signpost to start from. There's no doubt about it. People who know more about watches, however, know that you can get superb quality in other places. Seiko in Japan, the Germans are probably making close to the best watches in the world today. Few people know that. So it's a good place to start, and it's a good place to learn about watches and the qualities you can get. You don't have to stay there. And I think if you're somebody who likes to research and look into things, you'll quickly find out it's other places make great watches too.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So I can go back to my friend now and say it's not entirely true. It doesn't have to be a stipulation on the watch.
No, it doesn't. But I think that having been said, Bremont and Shinola are two very, very good examples of a great way to go about things today. They've both been really smart about how they've gone about their businesses, building their businesses. They're both great watches, superb quality. I would recommend them to anyone. I like the fact I was born in Detroit, so I really like the fact I like what Chanel is doing. I like their marketing. I like how they're building up the city. I like how they're being part of everything, but they chose to keep costs down. And in order to do that, they're sourcing parts in other places. If you start making, parts like that in your own country, the watch will indefinitely become more expensive. There's no doubt. There's no other way to do it. Mm-hmm. There's another brand out in Pennsylvania, Cobalt, who's begun making their own cases and some of their other parts, and their watches are about three times or four times the cost of a Shinola, and that's okay too. It's a different quality watch. It's a different thing. It's more American made, but it's not fully American made. It's hard to be that today. You'd have to go into the really upper end of watchmaking, into the independent watchmakers, to find that, and then we're talking about $100,000, $50,000, those kinds of prices.
Right. Okay. I mean, Elizabeth, you've got about 20 years of experience in this industry. You've seen many trends come and go. What do you think of like Apple bringing out their watches? And, you know, in contrast to like vintage watches and obviously analog watches, what is your opinion on those?
Mm-hmm. I think right now we're in the midst of some heavy trends. I think the Apple Watch is, it's been actually a great tool to make people aware of what's out there. Some people who are iPhone users or iPad users look at the Apple Watch and say, hey, I've never thought about wearing a watch in this generation. I'll wear that for a while, see how I like it. They'll probably find they're not going to like being connected all the time like that. Mm. And they may move on to an analog watch, to a mechanical watch even from there. So actually it's not, in my opinion, the Apple Watch is not a super threat. It's actually been been sort of a catalyst in getting watches back on the younger generation's wrists. The watch industry is extremely subjected to trends, has been in its entire existence. This is nothing different.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I guess similarly, this would be to have say that like the Kindles are knocking out books, you know, they're putting print out of work, but it's really getting people invested in reading in the first place, and then obviously people can pick up a book if they want. It's the same with what you're saying is the same with an Apple Watch can introduce other people to all kinds of horology.
Exactly. Or you can take it a step further in digital music. The vinyl records are coming back now, even as sort of the collector's editions. We have the same thing in watchmaking.
Mm. Okay, great. Lastly, Elizabeth, can I just ask you a rather personal question? Mm-hmm. How many watches do you own?
Yeah, I haven't really counted, but I'm not the typical collector. I don't have a huge collection. I think I have maybe 10 or 15 really nice watches.
Uh-huh. And when it comes to reviewing them, do they send you a watch and say, look, this is yours to keep, or we're going to send you this and you better mail this back recorded because this costs over 50 grand.
Exactly. No, I never get them to review to keep. It's always go back. The ones that I own are ones that I own.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your transparency. Elizabeth, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
It's quillandpad.com. Where people can go and check out all the reviews of the latest watches.
Exactly. And those will be the high-end watches. Mm-hmm. We won't have the Apple Watch on our site.
Okay. All right, brilliant. All right, thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Elizabeth Duer from Quill and Pad. Okay, lastly, we're going to have a bit of a fashion news roundup with our own fashion insider, André Letaboudière.
It's over to you, André Letaboudière.
Okay, so joining us now is André Letaboudière. How are you doing, André?
Oh, I'm fantastic. How are you, Peter?
I'm awesome. Our very own fashion insider. So what's new in the world of fashion this week, please, André?
Well, it's been quite an exciting week, actually, considering that it is London Fashion Week, which, of course, is all women's wear focused. The big news has come out is David Beckham's, his involvement with Kent and Carwin brand, which, for those of you who aren't aware of it, it's a Savile Row brand. And he's come on almost in a consultant capacity. The collection is actually really strong. Weirdly enough, it only focuses more on his rugby playing days rather than his football playing days.
I saw that, yeah. And also some cricket tops as well. I mean, I know the brand started off doing some stuff for the cricket, you know, making cricket sweaters, etc. So they haven't strayed too far away from that. But how much influence do you think he's had on the brand? On the collection?
It looks as if they've really kind of more dug into his archive. So really looked for things that would mean something to him and to people who are quite invested in David Beckham from the beginning of his career. For example, like the Three Lions emblem, that is found throughout the collection. And it's all quite vintagey. So it is almost like you're looking back into his own wardrobe, but it's been updated with a bit more of a contemporary feel. So that's really exciting. Actually, it's a new direction for the brand, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of turns up and what people react to. So, yeah, definitely very cool news.
Awesome. Yeah, it looks pretty good. You can actually head over to the site if you want to have a look at some of the collection, menswearstyle.co.uk. Looks very Oxbridge.
Yes.
Incredibly.
It looks
Oxbridge.
Like something that you'd want to go for a punt in.
Yeah, exactly. So, what else have you got your eye on this week, André?
Oh, well, unfortunately, I'm quite sad this week. Simply because summer really and truly has officially ended. But this is a great time and a great opportunity to have a look in your wardrobe and see what's coming up for next season. Just the bits and pieces that can be taken from last season, you know, see what condition they're in and, you know, just add some new accessories or something quite interesting. I had the pleasure also of attending an event with Next last week at the Rosewood Hotel. So massive shout out to the team at the Rosewood for treating us all so lovely and for Next, of course, for organizing it. And they're coming out with a full wool suit in their tailoring offering. Mm-hmm. Do you actually wear Next menswear? It's not something that's been much on my radar.
I used to. Not over these days. No, I used to have a girlfriend that would queue up at like 6 in the morning when the Next sales were on.
Yes.
Like for about 3 or 4 hours, it was insane. And then she would just come away with a £10 shirt that I'd hate. But what were the highlights then?
They've got they're trying their best not to alienate their core next customer, but they are a couple of highlights. They are putting in a bit of shearling detail into some of their bomber jackets. They had some actually really nice suits. Considering the low price point, I think it is something that guys can quickly go and try on and, you know, take it like off the peg. It's not a bad option considering it's high street. Mm. And they're only going for about 150 to about £200 per suit, which personally, I think that's actually really good, especially if it's good quality.
That's very digestible, isn't it? Especially if you want to have a couple of suits in your wardrobe. You don't just want the killer suit that you wear to every event. You want to have a bit of flexibility and some range there.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. So, definitely keep an eye out for next. They're coming in hot.
Awesome. I'll keep an eye out. Thanks, Andre. I'll let you get back to it. Oh, how's the pole dancing going?
It is fantastic. I'm currently training for a performance next month. So in one aspect, it's going really well. In the other aspect, I'm kind of freaking out slightly. But I'll let you know how it goes.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it. All right, take care, sweetheart. Speak to you
soon. All right. Bye, Peter.
Have fun. Bye.
Bye.
André Letterbaudier there. Okay, so we've come to the end of the podcast. It was a mammoth one this week, so congratulations to all that made it through. Thank you to my guests, Giles English, John Argento, Mike France, Elizabeth Duer, and André Letterbaudier, and of course, an honorary mention to Christopher Walken.
And I'd like to add my thanks to the members of the Academy.
Okay, Christopher, let's not get carried away here.
Thank you all.
Okay, let's not encourage him. Please, please, be seated. Be seated. Please. Okay, yep, enough of that. So if you want to head over to the website, it's www.menswearstyle.co.uk. There you'll find all the blogs, features, competitions. And if you want to follow us on the social, it's @menswearstyle. Okay, that's it from me. Until next week, I'll see you soon.